Hello and welcome to the Open Talent Report. This is the podcast where we discuss the emerging trends in labor law, employment law, independent work, and the gig economy, which many organizations are wrestling with due to the growth of the open talent and gig economy. I'm your host, Conor Heaney. When I'm not presenting the podcast, I'm the MD at CXC Global, EMEA, which compliantly connects talent and opportunity.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast, where I'm delighted to be joined by Bettina Schaller, President of the World Employment Confederation. I first had the opportunity to meet Bettina at last year's SIA Executive Forum, and I was immediately struck, Bettina, by your intelligence, your positivity, your can-do approach, and your very, very amusing directness, which I absolutely loved. And Bettina, I know we've been trying to get this recording for a while. I appreciate you're a very busy person, but a very warm welcome to the show, Bettina. We're so delighted to have you on. Thank you for coming on.
Conor, what a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for having me. And indeed, I do remember meeting you on occasion of that SIA conference. Notably, well, first of all, because of the experience of meeting you, of course, but it was actually, I think, the first event after this whole COVID craziness. And so just the possibility to mingle with real humans was just fantastic. But listen, what a pleasure to be with you today. And I'm tremendously looking forward to our conversation.
Wonderful, Bettina, and a very warm welcome to the show. So, Bettina, for the benefit of our audience, how did you become, what was your journey to become president of the World Employment Confederation and also the senior vice president of public affairs at the Adecco Group? So, you're, as I mentioned, you're an incredibly busy person, but I think it's a fascinating story, Bettina, and I'd be so grateful if you could share it with our audience.
With pleasure, Conor. And actually, it's true. I guess it's a bit of an unusual story. Look, the path was paved through my government affairs background. So I have always been active in the space of advocacy, in the space of lobbying to a certain extent, in the space of government affairs. And I worked in various industries. I also worked for public sector for the Swiss government at some stage. And then eventually, actually by coincidence, landed up in the industry of private employment services. That was in March 2010, when I actually joined the Adecco Group in this position of government affairs expert. And very quickly, part of that position was to get involved with those representative bodies in the world of work that deal with that labor market framework that businesses in the industry sell the solutions in. And so I was back then very quickly drawn to what was SIET in those days and is today World Employment Confederation. And in a way, you know, just climbed the ranks like all of us do throughout the years. So I held various positions at World Employment Confederation, always with this double role of indeed being active, for one of the members of World Employment Confederation. But really, you know, with that stern belief and understanding that if the pie gets bigger for everybody, then it automatically also does for each individual members. And that path then led me in September 2020 to the election as president of World Employment Confederation. So I'm one of those COVID representatives in a way. My predecessor didn't really get a farewell party and the farewell she would have deserved. And for sure, you know, I mean, do you get a party when you start? I don't know. We did a few virtual celebrations. But I must say, it's been an advantage also for me since I had been in the sector, you know, for a good 10 years and I knew the stakeholders, I knew the challenges. So to take on that role at that time was just, I think, that more feasible. So that's my path, really. I am as delighted and absolutely drawn to the sector as I was 12 years ago when I joined. I actually had no idea about the sector. But I think it's one of the most challenging and fulfilling industries to work for.
Yeah, I agree, Bettina, and I think COVID has really been a force multiplier for a number of things in the labour market and of course in the employment world. Mm-hmm. And it's just a fascinating period. You've got the platformization of work, the Uberization of work, the platformization of everything. You've got increased labour law in pretty much all the developed markets. You've got this complexity, uncertainty, volatility and ambiguity, right? This would be a financial trader's bloody dream, Bettina, but...
The good old VUCA, absolutely. The good. We've dubbed it for us as well. Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, and you know, again, you know, coming from my angle, which is this the advocacy, the policy angle, you know, we've seen an actionism by governments in this COVID crisis like we have never seen before. And it's been very interesting because, you know, in many countries we have been calling, you know, for certain labor market measures and we're always told, no, forget it, you know, that's not going to happen. Yeah. And then COVID happens. And unfortunately, sometimes, you know, you need such a horrendous crisis. But it actually did trigger some measures that, you know, looking back, we might have never seen if it wasn't for this crisis.
Yeah, I agree. And Bettina, just for the benefit of our audience, I'm sure most of our audience, of course, are familiar with the World Employment Confederation. But for those that, are not,
I wouldn't expect it.
Would you mind just giving a high level summary of what the WEC does? Thanks, Bettina.
World Employment Confederation is the voice, as we, you know, very humbly like to to call the organization, the voice of the private employment services industry. The very big focus is on advocacy, right? And when I talk about the industry, it is, in a way, you know, the classical recruitment, workforce solution, staffing companies. I mentioned one of its members earlier, since that is indeed my employer. Other members, corporate members, are Randstad, Manpower, Recruit, GI Group. In Europe, we have the House of HR, for example. And then there are the national federations in almost 50 countries. So the organized industry at the country level. And these two type of members are gathered in a World Employment Confederation with a focus, again, on advocating towards policymakers that the labor market frameworks allow for the business solutions to be you know, broad to the end clients, which, of course, are, on the one hand side, businesses, but on the other hand, also workers, candidates or associates, as it is.
Wonderful, Bettina. So you guys clearly have a very central role in terms of that advocacy piece. And I've been following with great interest some of your pieces on the EU directive on platform workers or platforms, Bettina.
Uh-huh. So, that was you.
Yeah.
That was you.
Yeah. I tell you, I can't wait to tackle this really interesting topic, because you guys in your organization, Bettina, have a really great way of making even the most boring legislative stuff interesting, right? Because it's so crucial.
Well,
it's so crucial. But
well,
yes, go.
Thank you for indicating that. No, indeed, you know, it's look, policymakers, I mean, they have the best of intentions, of course, you know, and we've had some fantastic stakeholders, you know, throughout the years. But here comes the but, you know, we do encounter, you know, very often still, let me just say, if I may, some, you know, dogmatic approaches to who should be acting in a labor market. And then there seems to be this, you know, innate, hesitation towards anything that is for profit. Maybe let me just really underline here for you know, any audience that would not be that deep into the topic, but you know, there is no fee charging to workers in our sector, right? So the clients cover all of that. And of course, you know, a big part of our work, a huge part of our work, is around all the compliance pieces, all the ensuring that the human rights at work are being respected. We do a lot of work in the migration and mobility context. So to come back to it, there is still also a big complexity of the labor market, and with COVID that has only increased. So we do think, as the World Employment Confederation, that our role in also reducing that complexity and in a way demystifying some of the misconceptions that are around when it comes to those acting in that world of work, you know, that is a key role for us to play.
Yeah, and you guys do an amazing job. And Bettina, I'd like to focus, if we may, on what has been described in various publications such as Bloomberg, The Economist, The Financial Times of London, The Wall Street Journal, and indeed, I believe, by the World Employment Confederation yourselves, as the labour market paradox. And for the uninitiated, in short, what that's describing is the COVID pandemic resulted in enforced or actual unemployment for millions of people. In fact, I think it was by a magnitude of three times more than were impacted or affected by the Great Recession of the period 2008-2010. And at the same time as that huge amount of unemployment and that those workers being displaced, you have pretty much every large, medium and some small organisations hiring or attempting to hire people like it's going out of fashion. So you've got this, and by the way, they can't find the people, as you well know, Bettina. So my question really is twofold. First question is, in your view, Bettina, what is the reason for this labour market paradox, as it's been described? And two, what do you think can be done to solve the particular problems that the labour market paradox has created?
I love the fact that you start with that question also, because in a way, Connor, that paradox is something that we've been witnessing already before COVID. And it just has to do with, you know, the very simple equation of demand and supply, right? And so one of the reasons why we've been looking at it, notably, and only a few people talk about that, but let me pick up Germany here. So yeah. One of the reason is actually the demographic development. It's, you know, just looking at the numbers of how many people a country has, and let's look at it from a country perspective more than maybe a sector perspective. We might dive into that. But, you know, Germany is set for a labor shortage of 7 million people by 2050.
Wow.
Amid that, what we call the aging crisis, right? And I'm singling out Germany here. But by the way, we see the same trend for Italy. We see the same trend for Spain. We see the same trend for the UK. It's basically a Western world, you know, challenge, really, as it is, right? And now, of course, you have, and here I'd like to fall back on numbers by CEDEFOP, that is an EU-based research institution. So they project for Germany to have nearly 20 million job openings. 20 million by 2050. So that's far more than any other European country. And again, I'm mentioning Germany. I don't know about you. I'm a Swiss national. So for me, you know, the German economy, I still, you know, and for a long time, you know, they're supposed to drive a big part of the Western of the Western economy, right? And now just to think about this, right? And then, so we've got that issue. But then on the other hand, indeed, companies just can't find the right type of people. So that is the correlation there. What is the reason? Of course, COVID played into it. Of course, we also see that there's a whole skills mismatch piece, and that's nothing new. We've been witnessing that firsthand, and to me, this is one of the big reasons, of course, for the numbers that we see today. So there are people who are unemployed, even though there the numbers are actually going down, right? There are employers or just jobs and projects that are not being filled, and the big reason there is that skills mismatch. But then, from what we see, there's just also, and now we come to the sector or the industry argument, there's just certain industries that are not attractive anymore. And that is a direct effect of COVID, whether, it's in the HoReCa, so hotel, restaurant and catering space. I don't know, I've been following the press lately and the numbers show it. The whole airline industry has tremendous issues there as well.
Yes.
There's people looking for jobs, clearly, but they just don't want to work, in certain sectors anymore. So, Connor, you asked me how to solve it. Well,
sorry.
I would still like to be sitting here, but I would probably be, sitting somewhere, maybe not in an office in Zurich, but somewhere, close to a beach. No, how to solve it? Look, I think there's four areas that we like to bring up here. One, we have to address structural inefficiencies, and I think you mentioned it earlier. There are always these structural issues, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, there's still labor market regulation that is just not fit for what is happening out there economically, what is happening out there in terms of the shifted demand and supply, what is happening out there in terms of that new understanding of flexibility that everybody has, so businesses but workers. The cost of labor, many governments haven't gotten that equation right, so there's structural inefficiencies. Then, of course, if we're looking at actually, bringing people back into the labor market, which is the big challenge today, it's the incentive system, right? Too many people are actually incentivized to stay out of the labor market right now. There's a few examples of countries there. A very prominent one is, of course, the United States. it's a difficult political topic. I can tell you we were active as a sector, indicating what effects certain support measures could have. And we understand what decisions were taken. But we now see, people are not coming back into the labor market because of that incentive system. Then there will be inefficiencies, less structural, but more due to the fact that we're not using technology to its fullest. We're pretty sure that there's quite some gains that can be done if you apply the right technology, and automation here just in the matching, of course, can probably already help quite a bit. And then finally, look, who would I be as president of World Employment Confederation if I wouldn't mention that one way to solve this labor market paradox is just to rely more and to build on the expertise of the experts, right?
Yeah.
Of us, of private employment services companies who, are there. They are the ones that know how to deal with it. They have the solutions. Sometimes labor market intermediation is needed. Sometimes new ways of direct sourcing are needed, that tech support that I mentioned. So, do that. It brings me back to the role of, all the players in the labor market. And if there's something we see throughout the world, it's that this cooperation and this, role of private employment services is not being harnessed to its fullest. So I see a huge potential in that space.
I agree. And I think the four points you outlined are on the money, as they say, Bettina, and thanks for sharing that. I had a question that follows from this, Bettina. Do you think at a government level we're really, and this is a general question about most governments, that we're really planning enough for the jobs of today and the jobs of tomorrow through the way our education systems are designed. And if I think back to my own school, and I loved school, I loved the social element of it, I liked the competition, but there was a lot of subjects that I hated, right, Bettina? I remember math, the way it was taught in Ireland at the time was that you had to learn trigonometry and, you know, get these bloody compasses out and pencils and draw all these lines. And I can't think of anything in my career to date where I've had to use that particular thing, but I can remember it because I hated it so much. But really my question is, can governments and should governments do more to reskill, upskill and train and educate people for the jobs, not just of today, because there's clearly this huge shortage that we've just spent some time discussing, but for the jobs of tomorrow? What's your take?
Listen, absolutely, absolutely. And I will, you know, join the fanfare of all of those who are in a generalized way, you know, disappointed, but also by now, I mean, just frankly, I'm quite appalled. How can governments still actually, how can they continue, you know, not to pay the attention that is needed to bring together in a way, and you mentioned the education system, that's you know, an absolute fundamental, right? So this alignment of the education system with the world of work. Now, you know, I mentioned before, I'm a Swiss national, even though I didn't grow up in this country, but the advantage I have with being based in Switzerland these days is I do see that those governments, for example, that that have taken the path of apprenticeship systems, right, of systems that are based on work readiness programs from very early days, and then also continue to offer these labor market close, so the proximity to labor market education, those countries are doing incredibly well in terms of managing their employment rates or unemployment rates, but also in terms of productivity. So there are ways out there. And again, you know, I've been witnessing now for the past 12 years what different administrations are looking to build. And in many ways, the intentions are there. There is a recognition that that alignment between the education and system and the world of work needs to be done. But it's still not enough. I mean, another important piece these days is to bring technology into the equation. So make sure that anybody is just being taught, and this is where your example in mathematics is a great one, you know. I mean, we're now seven generations further. So if you want to teach math, it's fine. But, you know, again, you know, do it the way that math should be taught these days, right? So to me, you need to add that piece. And then I'm a big fan of needing to add the sustainability piece as well, then, you know, into the whole how do you build your future workforce piece. So maybe to summarize, Connor, yes, there's still just not enough happening. To me, the big reason is that work, employment and education are still too politicized as well.
Yes.
You know, we see that a lot in countries that have a two-party political system. But how is it possible, you know, that you make it a political decision whether you're now going to train your people to be fit for the future and actually to make your country competitive, you know, compared to other countries. So there's only few countries that are up there. I mentioned those again, you know, that have a very structured approach to their education system. Maybe I just want to finish up. You know, we've been watching with incredible interest how a country like Singapore has been developing its labor market strategy for the past 10 years. And I can tell you that they're probably the closest to what we would say, you know, is a forward thinking and then not only thinking but acting, you know, country that that is already now, you know, they're looking at 2050. They're now setting the or making decisions a good 30 years ahead that will pave the way for the priorities that they have in 2050. So that's a very impressive one to watch. So it does exist.
Yes, it does. And the Singapore model is often touted, not just for for education, but their joined up approach in terms of how they think about their economy, what's required holistically for today, tomorrow, and well into the future. It's a remarkable country and location in terms
of... Exactly. And they have this ESG approach, you know, the way we understand it today. So the understanding it needs to be done in a sustainable, environmental, social governance way. So no, definitely a country to watch. Keep on watching.
Yes, I agree, Bettina. So we'll hope that some of our European governments will take heed of what's going on in Singapore. So, Bettina, earlier we mentioned the whole platformization of work. I suppose life has becoming platformized these days, right? But if we look at the platformization of work, in my view, Bettina, we have really two types of workers that are engaged through platforms. You've got what I would unfairly potentially describe as the low choice, no choice workers that are typically paid the least, have the least rights, have the least bargaining or negotiation power, and really need the work that they get through these particular platforms. And then on the other side of the equation, if you like, Bettina, you've got the high choice, high paid, high negotiation power, high bargaining power workers who have skills and experience that have an international dimension or portability dimension. They can pretty much work anywhere, any place, and name their price, so to speak. And I asked this question in the context of the draft EU directive on platform work that was published in December of 2021. And I think we all read it with interest, Bettina, and we've commented on it since. And some of your colleagues at the WEC have spoken with us, and they've got a really fascinating viewpoint on it. But my take on it is that as it's drafted today, and of course it is a draft, it's very broad and it's not hugely consistent in its approach. And I think it has the potential to create some really powerful unintended consequences in terms of creating a very rigid labour market, particularly where platforms are used. And really, I'd be keen to understand and know, Bettina, what's your view on the draft EU directive? Do you welcome it, or are you concerned by elements of it, or both?
Yeah, Connor, I mean, it's a great question, and since everything is still, you know, up in the air and in the making, let me see how I'll spin this one. I mean, the principle of the draft directive, actually, we welcome, right? Because it is one of the key issues out there. And you know, we've seen it in many countries. We still have the courts, you know, ruling, but there's contradictory rulings there as well. We know COVID has accelerated the piece around, you know, needing to, at the end of the day, it's about protection, right? It's about creating security for a certain participants in the labor market, right? So the fact that, you know, the Commission basically took the bull by the horns, I think is actually an act of, you know, showing responsibility. So on that one, you know, a big plus. Now, and I'm not going to get into, you know, how the whole process in the EU unfolds and how all the various, obviously, interests and points of view need to be taken into consideration. But it seems to us, indeed, that the Commission has chosen a path which is more the one that that will restrict, right? And the unintended consequences we share, right? So they will very likely, at the end, not be the security, you know, to all platform work users the way it was intended, and it will very likely also push certain well-regulated providers of platform work opportunities, in a corner, right? So we've obviously, and you said you've spoken to representatives of the sector, you know, we're very, very active in this consultation process and, you know, just looking to highlight as much as possible what could be happening in an industry that is there. I mean, it does exist, and we need to indeed make sure that we don't drive people away from almost the formal labor market, if I may say so.
Yes.
And make sure that we capture again, you know, all the workers that want to opt for these tools, you know. And again, we're hesitating to say that platform work is a form of work, right? I mean, we think it's more of a new online approach for matching demand and supply on the labor market, right? And it's a way of just providing self-employment a new hub. So it's still a space to watch. We're gonna have to be very wary indeed of not creating a 2 or 3 or whatever tier labor market here, where the ones who want to do it the right way, you know, in a way, are drawn out of it, and where we also, need to make sure that common denominator, you know, makes sense for all.
Yeah, I agree. I like you, Bettina. I welcome it because of that fairness piece. I don't think the courts, what do they say? Courts make bad law is the general thing. And I think the courts have been really creating rulings in the absence of legislation as it comes to gig and platform workers. Mm-hmm. And that has led to an inconsistent approach, to your point. And I fully agree with your analysis, Bettina. I think it's problematic in terms of how the draft will be how it will be implemented and interpreted at a local EU level. But I think we could spend bloody 2-3 hours debating the efficiencies or inefficiencies of that. But I think at its fundamental,
definitely. And actually, yeah.
Please continue.
Sorry to interrupt. But an incredibly important country to watch for us is Spain, right? Which is the first country that introduced a law for platform workers and riders more specifically, and it's now been running for a few months, and we're getting very mixed feedbacks there in terms of what it actually does to the riders themselves, right? So this is what we have to keep in mind, and so as we say in French, affaire à suivre, indeed.
I like that quote. And Bettina, it strikes me actually that there's going to be a potentially big opportunity here for private sector employment companies or labour market intermediaries actually to help the platforms interpret, implement and support this legislation, particularly if workers are presumed to be employees or worker. They've got that UK worker status, right? That's sort of in between You're not an employee, but you're not an independent contractor. And there's probably a great opportunity there for labour market intermediaries to really support those platforms, become compliant and engage workers compliantly in line with the directive. So I don't think it's all bad. I just think it adds that
Foucault piece that we discussed earlier, that volatility, uncertainty, complexity and ambiguity. But hey, listen, it might all go swimmingly, Bettina, and this conversation is redundant, but my suspicions are no.
Exactly. No, but my suspicion indeed is no as well. But of course, again, you know, I agree with you. The role of intermediaries, and we already see it now. There's, you know, many countries where labor market intermediaries are stepping in because the platforms, you know, cannot provide certain solutions. You know, starting with just the payrolling piece, for example. But you mentioned the UK. You know, there's example of again, you know, the benefits that can be provided through for the workers through certain platforms, etc. So, yeah, we're going to have to see. What we also see is it. It might very well, as so often, depend country to country. You know, what type of regulation will apply then. But no, an interesting space to watch for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Bettina, sorry, as you know, Bettina, I'm a bit of a labour law geek. And what one of the hypotheticals that was thrown up on a recent discussion was, well, let's say you've got Platform A headquartered in Ireland, right? It's in the EU. But in the era of mobile workers and mobile independent contractors, you might have a worker who's an independent contractor providing their services in France. So, where does the draft apply? Does it apply to the Irish interpretation of the EU directive, or does it apply to the French directive? So there's all these sort of what might seem esoteric or crazy hypotheticals, but in the new world of borderless hiring, it's going to be problematic to interpret all those different rules and regulations on a per country basis.
Indeed, Connor, and it's already happening, right? So this hypothetical is the reality already. So, you know, right now, businesses are trying to make it work somehow, and they will adjust again. But indeed, and you know, the fact that there is no clear line in a way just obviously indicates the complexity here. So yeah. Again, let's continue to play our role and just you know, stand for that compliant side of the industry that we are. Regrettably, there are certain things that, you know, we're witnessing in the industry that are not good, and those need to be tackled. Right? We cannot have illegal practices. We cannot have workers, you know, who are not being treated to, let's just use this term, the right way. That is unacceptable, and that's where we need to focus without any doubt.
Yeah, I'm with you, Bettina. Cheers to that. So, Bettina, one of the things that is also vexing me, and I think about a lot, is automation and its potential impact on jobs displacement. And I've been reading a lot over the last 2 years, a number of different economists, but one economist really struck me, a gentleman who's since passed called Vasily Leontief. And he developed a hypothesis or thesis looking at how the horse, which was the predominant means of goods transportation and people transportation before the advent of the internal combustion engine, what was really the predominant player. And then when the internal combustion engine was invented and subsequently adopted in trains, cars, trucks and whatnot, the horse was completely displaced, and millions of horses were subsequently put to pasture, and I'm probably being quite diplomatic in that term. So in short, his thesis is this, Bettina, that humans are potentially the new horses, and there's a significant risk to humans from jobs displacement through automation. Now, that is a rather dystopian viewpoint. I appreciate it. But but what's your take on it? Are you concerned, Bettina, by automation and jobs displacement, or do you think humans are so creative that we'll create new jobs and opportunities in the absence of that or because of that?
Well, yeah, Connor. I mean, what an incredible thesis or hypothesis, right? Look, I'm one of those who's on that second line, right? I do believe that that there will always be jobs. And, you know, everybody talks about today already about all those new jobs we don't even know exist, you know, or will exist. So how hypothetical is you know, that that statement that I'm making. But no, I'm a believer. Yes, jobs displacement, you know, they will. And to me, they're synonymous with evolution in a way, right? With progress, with innovation. So there will be those jobs that that will require people to move away from the labor that they've been doing because they're just not required anymore. And it goes back then to me to that point we made earlier about the necessity of countries. And here, let me talk about businesses as well, of just, you know, planning, of having an understanding of where things will be going and of applying the right mix of looking after your current workforce. And by the way, here, by far, will I not imply that that you need to have FTEs, full-time employees only. So I'm obviously advocating for the need to look at the very, you know, fluid workforce, or a workforce composed by what we call diverse forms of contract or diverse forms of work. So to come back, make sure that you can anticipate those people who will be displaced. That will happen, and I'm even going to go further. I think it's key again. You know, I'm not a chemist or a scientist, but I believe, for instance, in, you know, cellular regeneration. So I guess that's a bit of a strange leap here as well.
No.
So, you know, it will happen. I, in a way, it's difficult for those, clearly difficult. It's impacting immensely, you know, for those who are on the receiving end. You know, again, this is something that can be addressed if the right planning and the right forward-looking approach is applied.
Yeah,
I hope it's not too simplistic, but yeah. And then I must admit, Connor, I'm not a horsey person. I'm more of the golfer.
I'll have to get a new hypothesis. I'll have to find a new economist.
No, it's actually a great one. I think, yeah, it gets us all thinking. That's for sure, Connor.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And you know, Bettina, I like that point, that analogy you made around cellular regeneration. It's a bit like, is it Joseph Schumpeter's idea around capitalism, that it's a force for creative destruction? And we're tackling some big topics today, but I bloody love it,
yeah,
Bettina.
Indeed.
Yeah, and
for those who listen to this at breakfast, you know, it's a light.
Yes, this will set you up for your day. And Bettina, moving on to
exactly.
I'd like to move on, if we may, Bettina, to what on the face of it might not be that thorny an issue, but it's on the topic of remote work. So as our audience, and of course you will be well aware, many industries and organizations and sectors were essentially forced into a remote working experiment through the COVID pandemic. Governments essentially mandated the stay at home, if you were lucky enough to keep your job, of course, or in a sector that was deemed that it could stay open, albeit remotely. So, you know, millions of people, of course, were forced into this experiment, and largely it seems to have worked, right? The lights are on, well, for the moment anyway. Commerce, the wheels of commerce are turning. Workers are generally happy, it seems. But my issue really comes from this, Bettina. I note that there's some draft legislation essentially enshrining a right to remote work in countries and locations such as Ireland and the Netherlands. And whilst I won't ask you to comment on the specific legislation, because I appreciate you probably don't have it in front of you, for me, I'm concerned about that because, in short, there's a large part of the working population that will never be able, well, not never, but will find it difficult to remote work. The bus driver, the nurse, the doctor, the factory operative, the technician, maybe the airline pilot, these so-called deskless workers, Bettina. And for me, that creates a fundamental unfairness, at least in my view. So what's your take on remote work, and what are your guys' views on it, specifically around this legislation enshrining some form of right to remote work, Bettina?
It's a good point around having to obviously start with all of those who cannot benefit from what, in that case, the legislation is looking to do, because in a way, it actually introduces a new form of discrimination, which is one of those unintended consequences that that, you know, we called out earlier, that that needs to be thought about. And again, no doubt, again, that there's, you know, very good intentions on wanting to legislate. It's probably also one of those areas where now, you know, certain administrations feel that they're actually reacting to the times, or, you know, even thinking ahead and, you know, wanting to be going with the times and feeding into the, you know, future of work debate. Look, what we're seeing is just there's no one size fits all, right, on this one. And, you know, for any framework that wants to be prescriptive here again, that will cause certain parts of and certain actors again of the labor market that will be left out. That will be left out.
Yes.
And so it will create, we talk about a two-tier society, but a multiple-tier society. And one thing we really need to, I hope, take away as a lesson, you know, from the COVID piece is how important certain contributors, again, to the labor market are. You know, we had this conversation around essential workers and, you know, who those are, who actually kept the lights on in a country, in an economy. And now let's be sure again that we are as inclusive as possible when we're looking to take into consideration the new forms of work. So in summary, I would also be very cautious in wanting to come forward with any prescriptive piece here about how, you know, remote work should look per se.
Yeah, I agree, Bettina. And I also feel, and I say this, I suppose, through the looking glass, my own organization, we are fully remote and distributed and have been since we were conceived in Europe 7 years ago, Bettina. Mm-hmm. So I love remote work, but I feel that maybe remote work has been oversold in media organizations as some sort of panacea for solving all the ills of work, right? but that's just my own probably jaundiced view on that.
Yeah, maybe. Whereas I agree. Whereas it's just really causing a lot of, you know, it needs to be done the right way. And again, even I'm, well, in your organization, Connor, I'm sure everybody's incredibly happy and satisfied.
Thanks.
And again, you set yourself up, as you just said, as a remote work company. But, you know, for many businesses, they've now only shifted to that. So there's a lot of cultural related and leadership related and, just in general, you know, approach to your daily work related issues that need to be taken into consideration. And the question there is it up to government to prescribe that, you know? Yeah.
I don't think so, Bettina, but but thank you, Bettina. And Bettina, I'd like to get your take on this area. I've been following the HR tech boom, if you like, or the HR tech investment scene very closely over the last 3 years. But last year was, the year 2021, was the highest amount of money or capital invested in HR technology. Around $13 billion US dollars was invested in HR technology startups and scale-ups. And my question really is, do you think there's a bubble forming in the HR tech space, or do you think this is just a natural consequence of the remote working boom, the new way of working, borderless hiring, and all the other trends that are emerging as a result of COVID?
Well, Connor, you and I have been looking at the same things, I must say, because it's been fascinating to watch, indeed. So again, I mean, 13 billion, there's no other sector that has seen that that increase, right? I mean, we've seen the investment activity has more than doubled, right? End of 2021, it stood at 7.7 billion. We see that it's the sector with the largest increase in deals. So there were, in 2021, again, 30 so-called mega round deals of 100 million euro and plus.
Wow.
And 10 firms achieved the unicorn status middle of last year already. So that's above 1 billion US this time in valuation. So that space is incredible. Now, is it a bubble? Is it a cloud? You know, I'm not a meteorologist, right? I think it's definitely the hottest industry right now. Yes, COVID has accelerated that clearly. There is an understanding, though, that the both, again, in a way, antiquated resources that have been available so far are now being, you know, jacked up, just looking at the amount of tech players in the industry. And then there are those new ways of working, the new needs, the new requirements, right? So I think it's going to stick around for some time. And I think it's going to continue to attract a lot of financing. There will be consolidations, clearly, and we're seeing things happening in that space already. If you look at the whole, you know, human capital market ecosystem, it's just also interesting to see, you know, who's ventured into it. So, you know, starting as well with big consultancies, for instance, you know, who are busy buying up certain tech companies there. So my anticipation would be that this is going to stick around for a while, and it's going to be something in up there in the skies that will be there for a while. One comment I wanted to make in this space is that, again, regulation might be the big party pooper here, because out of this necessity to protect the worker, right? And it's something we're seeing in the AI space, for example. Where there's quite a few initiatives around, obviously needing to make sure that ethics are applied in the AI space, that the whole biases piece is looked at properly. Again, it comes from the need to address anti-discrimination measures. So that's something that could just put a little bit of a break on what the potential of technology is in the recruitment, in the workforce solution space.
Thank you, Bettina. So, Bettina, just a couple of final questions, if we may. So, Bettina, what I wanted to ask you is, we discussed the labour market paradox and labour scarcity. It often strikes me that Africa as a talent pool is often forgotten or indeed misunderstood. Do you think Africa as a talent pool is something that could and should be explored by more companies around the globe? And what do you think could be done to help facilitate that or improve the messaging around that?
Connor, I'm a huge fan of African talent. Huge, huge. And I've been lucky. My husband is South African, right? So I've been lucky because I've witnessed the development of African talent. And of course, here, as usual, let's be very careful in generalizing, starting with South Africa that has a superb education system, of course, and an economy that that is there also to absorb most of the parts of African talent. Then one needs to look at neighboring countries, but the more you go up north, there's different situations, of course. But overall, if you look at the arrival of technology in the African continent and what that has triggered in terms of innovation and creativity, it's been fantastic to watch. The simplest these days is also to join talent blogs and talent platforms of talent across Africa, and then you see it. So I think it's one of the most underestimated pools of talent in general. I think that in the whole diversity and inclusion conversation that is taking place, rightly so these days, African talent should absolutely be considered. I think that with, and we talked about remote work, so the possibility that you have of tapping into talent that lives all around the world. So again, talent across the African continent should be absolutely considered as well. And I think that in any conversation that looks to also capture the voice of voices of young talent, those young African professionals should absolutely be part of the table. You know, in many ways, the African continent, and again, I apologize for generalizing, but has benefited for many years from tremendous support measures, right? Development aid support measures. And the great thing is there, again, that there are, people who have also been educated outside of the continent. I'm one of those who thinks, ideally, with issues of brain drain, if there was a way of that talent going back and contributing to the country's economic prosperity and social development, that would be wonderful. But again, it's, as you can see here, I'm 100% black and white in terms of here wanting to have a very strong opinion about how important it is and how much of an advantage it would be for any business and any organization to take talent from the African continent in.
I agree, Bettina, and I think people like us can really continue that advocacy and that evangelizing about what a great, on a general basis, of course, what a great location it is and how great the education system is. And I think that borderless hiring, that remote working can really open up Africa and all the benefits of the resource and talent pool there. So I think it's incredibly exciting. And there's some really
absolutely
interesting...
Count on me for that one.
Good.
On me.
Excellent.
One thing I love in Africa as well is the whole gender discussion. And when I look at those fantastic, strong women, that's obviously one that that many people in other parts of the world could benefit from that social fabric that you see in some African countries, and how that translate into the business world.
I agree, Bettina. And Bettina, just before we finish up, I'd be keen to hear your thoughts.
What?
On it. I know, I'm sorry.
How do you mean we finish up?
I don't.
No.
But I'd love to get your thoughts, and it's a question, Bettina, we ask all our guests, which is, which is this: what if any is your prediction or predictions for the future of work?
Oh, the easy question at the end, I see, Colin. What is my prediction? That's the silver, the crystal bowl again. What is my prediction? Look, I mean, it's again, as an industry, it's the place to be. I think, golden times ahead. It's a sector that touches all others, right? Everybody's rethinking how to organize and how to shift their approach to work and to workers per se. The future of work clearly is one of those huge areas of transformation. To me, it's going to be heavily linked to any concept of flexibility, and therefore the need that we're going to have to be very open, that there's no one size fits all, which just makes it even more difficult. But I think even within industries, there's going to be different success stories. It's going to depend on the culture a lot. So these are elements that the future of work will bring with it a lot. I think it's going to be all about that right mix of technology and the human factor. We actually haven't talked about a lot about the human factor, and that's something I really wanted to do, Connor. So I'll just make sure, in these last seconds to
highlight
how important, that is, and that should be the red thread, right, across any conversation that has to do with our sector and the future of work is the need to, put the individual in the middle. And that's going to be a big shift also for the individual per se. You can't expect for the state and the government to do things for you anymore. It doesn't mean you won't be protected, but you just have to pick up more responsibility for yourself. So that future of work will be about the individual within the broader community, but you're going to have to navigate your own path and show flexibility and leadership on that.
Yeah, I think that's a lovely way to finish our conversation and really putting the human in all this.
What a pity, Connor!
I know, I tell you, it is a pity, Bettina, because I tell you, and I'm sure our audience will feel the same, it's been a pleasure speaking and listening to you, Bettina. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think I've learned a lot, and I think our audience will too, Bettina. So may I thank you, Bettina. This has been a blast, and just for the benefit of our audience, Bettina, should they wish to reach out to you on any matters that we've discussed, where's the best place to find you without, of course, breaching your confidentiality or privacy?
No, not at all. And first of all, Connor, please, I'm the one thanking you. Your questions definitely got me thinking. And that's what we need these days, actually. More than pretending that we have the answers, I think we need to have the ability to ask the right questions. And so I'm the one thanking you. If anybody listened in, well, thank you for, spending those minutes listening in. And indeed, if you want to join me anytime, I would say that LinkedIn these days is the safest way to connect with me. I'm usually only about 2 or 3 weeks late in answering my my contacts and so. But definitely, I'm also on Twitter for those who want to follow that. But I would advise the LinkedIn route. And then there's, of course, the website of World Employment Confederation. The website is wecglobal.org. There's a way of getting in touch with us at the organization there. So please do get in touch, and actually please have a peek at the site. You'll notably see there the latest that we as a sector have been doing in the context of the Ukraine crisis, which might be actually a conversation we could have next time, Connor. But for now, I already tremendously look forward to anybody who looks to reach out. Thank you, Connor.
Bettina, thank you so much. And that was really wonderful. And Bettina, we will have you back on to discuss the Ukraine issue and what can be done to solve potentially and help the people that are coming from Ukraine, and also more about the human as well. But Bettina, wonderful. I can't wait for that. And Bettina, wishing you a great day ahead. Thanks ever so much for your time. That was really enjoyable. So thank you so much, Bettina. And I will see you at the World Employment Confederation Global Conference at the end of May. So for any of our listeners that want to go, please check out the WEC website. It's really fantastic. So thank you, Bettina.
Indeed. Thank you, Connor.